Professor Flammiano is a professor and interim director at the School of Media Arts and Design at JMU. Her work has appeared in Visual Communication Quarterly and Southern Cultures. So afterwards, we'll have Daphne Spain, who's sitting here in the front row. She is the author of Constructive Feminism, Women's Spaces, and Women's Rights in the American City. She is the James M. Page Professor of Urban and Environmental Planning in the School of Architecture, that's here at UVA. Her previous books include How Women Saved the City and Gendered Spaces. So without further ado, I give you Professor Flammiano.
Thank you. It's exciting to see the book cover so big on the screen there. So just give me a minute to take that sight in. Beautiful. Again, thank you for being here. And it's an honor and a privilege to be sharing the stage with Susan Freeman and Daphne Spain, two scholars whose work I really admire. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my book and also read some brief passages from it. So let me just begin by sort of talking a little bit about why I wrote a book about Hansel Meith. Well, I first discovered her back in about 1998 when I was working on my dissertation at the University of North Carolina. And that dissertation dealt with Life magazine, and specifically the photo essay as a format, as an innovation that Life was sort of known for and held itself out there as the innovator of. What I found in that research was it was more complicated. There were a lot of contributing factors, and really, I think European magazines deserve more credit for inventing the photo essay. But I also discovered in my research Hansel Meith, who was one of the first women to work at Life. Margaret Bourquite was the first, so Hansel was the second. And the more I learned about Hansel Meith, the more fascinated I became, because she seemed like she was a fish out of water at Life magazine. I learned that she had previously been employed as a farm worker and that she was born in Germany in 1909 and was a radical, basically. She was a supporter of labor. She was a very independent woman who for a time had roamed around Europe as a vagabond and taken on the name Hansel. Her given name was Johanna, but she became Hansel and donned Lederhosen and passed herself off as a man to avoid questions on the road and to avoid sexual assault on the road. Anyway, I decided that Hansel Meith didn't really fit into my dissertation, so I had to wait a while and started writing about her really when I went to JMU in 2000. So that's sort of a little background on Hansel Meith and my project. Let me, move forward by talking about some of her images that are best known. And this one is probably her best known single image, which was a source of some frustration for her because she was not really a believer in a single image or a great work of art. She was more about using photographs to tell stories. So she was interested in using a series of images to tell a story and to develop characters and to sort of... this was, in fact, part of a longer story, but it was seized on by the editors for other purposes. Let me back up a little bit. I have one of the things I'd like to do today is to let Hansel Meith's voice be heard a little bit, because one of her experiences and one of her frustrations at Life was that even though her photographs were published and she created hundreds of photographs and dozens of photo essays during her time at Life magazine, her voice was hardly ever heard. And she definitely had an opinion and an idea about a lot of stories, but that often got buried or subverted or actively sort of contradicted in the way the editors selected the story and the way the writers told it. So I wanted to just say a few things about, in her words, so I'm going to quote Hansel Meith on a few ideas or a few points. The first quote has to do with her style of working. So she was kind of... contrasting her style of photography with that of her partner, Otto Hegel, who was also a photographer and who was also her husband. So here's what she said. "The first thing I saw, bang, Shoot it, shoot it. I may never get it again. I was always afraid that this is the moment that you have to capture. Well, that means that I overshot many stories. I shot hundreds of pictures when maybe 20 were used. Otto, when 20 pictures were used, he came home with at most 30. So she was kind of comparing her sort of impulsive style of work with Otto's more meticulous style. Another quote that I wanted to share with you had to do with her experiences as a woman in a very gendered space, and that's photojournalism in the 1930s. And so imagine being out in the field with a pack of male photojournalists and being a German immigrant who stood about five foot two and was kind of on the shy side. And here's what she had to say about that experience. I felt I was resented. Being a shrimp and being foreign-born and being a woman, the whole gamut of things. And this became especially uncomfortable and sort of dangerous when she was sent to cover certain stories. The ones that she hated the most were Life Goes to a Party, sort of those lightweight, 1930s versions of E! Entertainment or, celebrity news. So there was one party at the Waldorf Astoria where she was probably one of two women at the party. The other woman popped out of a cake with little or no clothing on. So here's what she had to say about that experience. Whenever I went down an aisle, I couldn't see what was going on because they didn't have any lights on. But every time I was going down a special aisle, some old geezer was grabbing me. She said she smashed her heavy camera over his head. And there was a similar incident at a film opening in Atlanta. A little runt of a guy used my shoulder and then my head as a tripod to get what was going on. And I warned him a few times, please don't do that. You shake my arm, you shake my camera. It was about three times I told him. When it was going on the fourth time again, I just turned around and beamed him. So she was spunky and she tended to make light of these kinds of incidents, but I'm sure that they weren't easy. For her to take, and I'm sure it was difficult. So I'm going to just move on to this picture. And this is from 1939. A couple of names for this. A rhesus monkey sitting in water up to his chest. That's sort of the current title. But when it was published in Life, the title was Misogynist Monkey. And let me just explain a little bit about the context for this photograph. It was part of a scientific story, and she was a pioneering photographer in many ways, and one way was that she was part of a small cadre of science photographers at Life, and all of them were men except for her. And so she went to Puerto Rico in 1939 to photograph this colony. It was the Cayo Santiago monkey colony. And she had the opportunity to work with a primatologist, C.R. Carpenter, who was overseeing the research there. She shot more than 100 photographs, and Life initially published them in a short article focusing on the research. And the research was designed to find cures for childhood diseases. But what happened to the story was it was supposed to be part of a series, but the series never materialized. Instead, a couple of weeks later, Life published this article, and the editors decided to call him a misogynist monkey. And they blamed his expression on noisy females. So you can see it sort of plays on gender ideology in a very blatant, our eyes, crude way. And Hansel Meath was not too happy about that. There were others who were not happy about it, including some scientists who I was able to connect with. They actually reached out to me. One of them is Matthew Kessler, who used to teach here at UVA. He's now in West Virginia. Also, Richard Rawlings was a photographer at Cayo Santiago for many years. And they were interested in my writing about this photograph because they looked at it from a very different angle. Anyway, talking to Richard Rawlings, a scientist, here's what he had to say about the idea of applying the word misogynist to this photo. He said, "It's a joke. It's a joke to use the word misogynist for this photo if one knows anything about mammals in general or primates in particular. Throughout a monkey's life, its closest contacts are the females who give birth to it, nurture it through at least the first 3 years of life or more, and post-dispersion of young males into non-natal troops. The young males devote most of their activities to gaining access to a new social group for purposes of mating. So it's 180-degree opposite of what life wanted you to think, which was that this monkey was trying to get away from the females and escape their sexual advances." So ultimately, Meath saw this photograph, despite its popularity, she saw it as more of a failure than a success. And here's what she had to say. "It was a scientific story. If you wanted to use that as an example of how a scientific story works, it's a fiasco. They cut the whole science out of it. The whole work the doctors did down there was all cut out. That was used at Harvard later on, but not in life. It was because Harry Luce," she's talking about Henry Luce, the publisher, "Harry Luce looked like a monkey when he was angry, and writer Alex King, being such a joker, he could get it over. The whole story didn't count anymore. It was that one lousy picture that had actually nothing to do with the story I went there to do." So the more I looked at this image and read about it, the more I found that there were several layers to the story. So I just wanted to share a couple of them with you there. And I hope I'm doing okay on time. Okay. Well, before she worked at Life, Hansel Meath was a farm worker, as I mentioned, a migrant farm worker. And this is one of the pictures that documented her life among the cotton pickers in California. And this was taken in 1934, cotton picker family around a fire. And I'll just say a few words about the photograph. I don't think I have any quotes from Meath about this, but it is worth noting, I think, that this time period and this type of photography kind of marked a turning point in her life. She and Otto had a child who was born while they were migrant farm workers, and her name was Maria. She was killed in a migrant farm camp. She was around two at the time, by a truck driver. And it was hard to find, there were contradictory stories about exactly what happened, but from what I could tell, the child was killed by a drunk driver who was also a foreman at the camp. So this picture kind of represented her coming to terms with that tragedy and picking up a camera as a way of going on, as a way of surviving and expressing herself and also connecting with the people around her. So the context and setting of Cotton Picker Family is interesting for many reasons. One of them is because it provides a glimpse into the workers' life, into the workers' lives. And you can see here that the cotton field really dominates the background, as it did the lives of the cotton pickers. As Linda Gordon notes in her book about Dorothea Lange, farm workers occupied two sites, fields and camps, corresponding to labor and living conditions. And in this particular image, you can see how those two worlds are very closely compressed, and there's very little line between the family domestic area where their fire is and the field where they worked. Cotton Picker Family also shows two sides of life for migrant children. On the one hand, they played just like any other children played. The cotton picker's sons here are shown with some what appear to be store-bought toy guns. On the other hand, these migrant children worked, unlike their peers from more middle-class or wealthier families. The young boy at the lower left corner, is wearing a holster to carry his toy gun, and he also has a child-sized bag over his shoulder to carry cotton. And I think one of the things that's extraordinary about Meath's pictures of farm worker children and others that she took in San Francisco of poorer children was that she didn't depict them as objects of pity, but she did show them as a symbol of the contradictions of migrant camp life. On the one hand, she embraced it for its camaraderie and the closeness, but of course it was also a dangerous place for a child to grow up. Another place where Hansel Meath spent some time is sewing factories. And this is a very much a gendered space, not a voluntarily gendered space, but a place where women worked and labored. And she was very familiar with these kinds of places because back in Germany, she had left her village and gone to Stuttgart, where she worked in a sewing factory. And she recalled of those years, or the time that she spent there, how drained that job left her. After a 12-hour day, she said, I returned home, falling across the bed, often too tired to undress, too tired to dream. And so there's another image of a sewing factory, but this one was for Life magazine. And in contrast to the sweatshop environment of the Chinatown sewing factory that we just saw, this one is in New York, and this is in a story about the International Ladies Garment Workers Union that was published in 1938. So here we have a place, a workplace that is large and airy, and a factory floor where in the magazine layout, you see the woman who's pointing. She was, the title sort of echoed the point by, it was titled, A Great and Good Union Points the Way for America's Labor Movement. And what she was pointing to in the layout was the union's resort in the Poconos, Camp Unity. So it was really a tribute to a certain kind of unionism, and very interesting story that featured women, for the most part, not working. It was a story about labor, but there were only two images out of 20-some that actually showed women working. Instead, what you saw were women playing at the Camp Unity, horseback riding on the cover, or doing various other fun activities. And here's a, this is, I know I'm running out of time, but this image is just sort of a transitional image that shows that Meath was sensitive to and very interested in racial issues and the presence of African-American women in a union that was predominantly Jewish and Italian in its composition and in its demographics. And just to quickly go through some of her other images that show women. I think it's interesting, I'm just going to very briefly talk about this one. This is a photograph of Augusta Savage, a sculptor, and it appeared in a 1937 article about, the title of it was Negroes, America. So that was the title. The subtitle was, don't have it here, but it was something like Negroes, America's racial, America also has a racial issue, kind of a reference to racial tensions in Europe. But Augusta Savage and this young woman who was not identified, I wanted to just point out that this photograph was taken by another German immigrant, Alfred Eisenstadt. And so it was interesting that the two images in this story on African Americans, the two full page, more sort of, the two images that kind of challenged stereotypes and showed African Americans sort of as more fully formed individuals were taken by immigrants. And I think I'm out of time now, so I'm just gonna end there. And my last couple of slides were just sort of continuing the theme of Hansel Meath using her photographs to kind of push against the boundaries of the ideologies regarding race and gender that were surrounding her. So thank you very much.
Oh, stop. stop moving the mouse. No, I didn't hear that. Sorry. All right. Well, I'd like to thank the Virginia Festival of the Book and also Susan Freeman for offering to moderate this event. And the stories I'm going to tell you today are about people and places from the glory days of feminism, the second wave of feminism. And this is 40 years ago, but the stories are still relevant today. And this slide illustrates some of the anger that second wave feminists felt about their sense of powerlessness. And so they were responsible for passing legislation and creating actual places where that legislation was able to be played out. So these stories have relevance today because of continued threats to women's reproductive rights, and those were established in 1973 with Roe v. Wade. And they're relevant because Title IX has been used as a tool with which sexual harassment and sexual assault on campuses can be challenged. And there would be no legal abortions and no Title IX without the second wave. So the premise of my book is that social movements have spatial consequences, both deliberate and unintentional. Now, let me give you a few examples. Abolition eliminated auction blocks from slave trading cities, and it also created a new use for churches and homes that became stopping points on the Underground Railroad. The temperance movement that created prohibition, it eliminated saloons, but it also gave birth to speakeasies, which were less easy to regulate and to tax, certainly. And then the civil rights movement, which is most often compared with the women's movement, the civil rights movement racially integrated public spaces, movie theaters, bus stations. But that pent-up anger that was caused by the sluggish pace of change that fed into the Black Panther movement, it fueled urban rebellions that burned large swaths of urban real estate, destroyed acres of property, and decimated African-American neighborhoods. So these are all examples of deliberate and unintended consequences of social movements. So the second wave also had spatial consequences. And I wanted to discover how feminists created places to establish and reinforce their newly won rights, their legal victories. These were the deliberate efforts. And I also wanted to know how the crusade produced unintentional spatial consequences. I chose Boston and Los Angeles as case studies to highlight the activism of the day, but I also documented the women's centers, the places I'm going to talk to you about, in cities and college towns across the country during the 70s. So to oversimplify the women's movement, I've divided it into two branches. The reformers sought legal measures that would give them equality with men, and the radical activists demanded a revolution in sex roles. There was a unity of goals, but a completely separate approach to tactics and how to achieve these. The reformers were led by Betty Friedan, who founded the National Organization for Women, along with Pauli Murray. And that was the group, those group of women who were largely white middle-class professionals. They lobbied for Roe v. Wade, equal credit, enforcement of the Equal Pay Act, and Title IX. But in contrast, the radical activists had no single leader. They were divided up in consciousness-raising groups, in political collectives, particularly like Boston's Bread and Roses, across the country. My intent with this book is to bring recognition to some of those people and the places they created. I'm thinking of them as pioneers. They used existing buildings, so I'm arguing that they changed the use of buildings and in that sense gave women a different destination to go in cities, increased their mobility, and also fought for the types of rights that they were achieving. They were appropriating old space for new uses, and they put material form to women's rights. So I'm interested in how those legal changes and the material forms, the actual buildings, work together to enhance rights. So here's some of the deliberate spaces that I'm talking about. The women's centers I use as representative of rights to an independent identity and autonomy. And women's centers were places that were created mainly by collectives. Bread and Roses was one in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Feminist women's health clinics. These were a testament to reproductive rights. And before abortion was legal, they would help with abortion counseling. They would be referral services to, and when I say legal, in many states, abortion was legal, but a woman had to have the permission of a panel of doctors and prove that she would not harm herself or harm others if she couldn't get the abortion. So the health clinics talked about contraception, about family planning, about all sorts of women's health issues, and they were one of the first efforts to pay attention specifically to women's health needs. Feminist bookstores, I think, represented the rights to intellectual development, the rights to recognize that women were both active writers contributing to the intellectual streams of the day, and they were readers. They could be a market of readers. And then domestic violence shelters. Rights to personal safety, of course, are one of the most critical rights if you're thinking about human rights in any country. So I have a few images. And this one is the takeover of a building at Harvard University in 1971 by the collective Bread and Roses. And they were intent on creating a women's center. They wanted a particular space, excuse me, where women's priorities would be put first. They wanted lesbian spaces. They wanted daycare. They wanted to have fun. And they occupied this building for 10 days. It was a building that architecture students were using to study structures. It had been condemned by the university. It was going to be razed and turned into faculty housing. And the women who occupied it declared it a women's space and declared that Harvard owed the community of Cambridge a women's space, and it should also address lesbian issues. The banner over the door, Free Erica, that was Erica Hudgens, Black Panther activist who was in jail at the time. So these activists were coming out of the New Left and the anti-war movement. The reformers, represented by Betty Friedan, were coming out of the civil rights movement. So they also came out of, excuse me, different traditions of what the background of their tactics were for the second wave. And then after many days of occupation and many negotiations with the administrators at Harvard, they actually achieved their goal of finding a women's center, a house on Pleasant Street in Cambridge, Mass., which still exists to this day. And the cover of my book is a drawing of this women's center. And this is a photo that I took. So it's... This is really a testament to what women's activism could do at the time, and collective activism, so that many, many groups were combined in trying to achieve this space. And the types of things they offered here were the discussion groups that were so important to women who were trying to achieve their own voice, establish autonomy. this was the another set of discussion groups. And you notice this drawing, it's an attempt to be multicultural. The woman in the middle is supposed to be African-American. And they're talking about issues like depression, money and values, coping with the holidays. And then a lesbian mother's rap group, and this was also a consciousness-raising group. Lesbians played a large role in establishing many of these institutions that I studied. And it was a heady time for them as well, because they were coming out of the closet, they were finding new confidence, and they were able to establish a separate identity, sometimes a separateness that tore the movement apart, but they were supported by the women's movement and found their own voice that way. And I keep talking about finding a voice, and this was very important to the era. So that was an example from Boston. In Los Angeles, there was also a women's center, and they published this newsletter called Sister. It had circulation of 3,000 or 4,000 people at the time. And this is one of my favorite covers. It's Wonder Woman vanquishing all the foes of women's health. She says, with my speculum, I am strong, I can fight. And these images at the bottom represent the Catholic Church and the American Medical Association and Planned Parenthood, which was considered to be a eugenics movement at the time. And feminists were not at all in sympathy with Planned Parenthood. That's changed somewhat since. So this is the special issue on health care, self-help care, that Carol Downer, who was one of the women who I interviewed in Los Angeles, was instrumental in beginning in Los Angeles, the self-help clinic number one. And these feminist women's health centers were, there were about 25 of them during the 70s and 80s. There are many fewer of them now. And if you notice the banner at the bottom right, the slogan is, my body, my life, my choice. And this is where the pro-choice slogan has come from. And Carol Downer, by the way, is still working with, at age 80, she's still working with a website called Women's Health and Women's Hands, so she's still in there swinging. Our bodies ourselves, this takes us back to Boston, and you can see this was my copy scribbled on. I've got some directions on there for some reason, but this is one of the earliest publications, and it was considered the Bible of women's health. It's still being published today. And it was created by the Bread and Roses Health Collective that then went on to create the Women's Center as well. Or actually, the Health Collective came out of the Women's Center organizers. And this was a Women's Center in Cambridge. And all of these places were contested spaces in the sense that they were challenged at every turn by the public health department, by licensing regulations, by the state. The next institution I looked at were the bookstores, and Sisterhood Bookstore in Los Angeles was one of the most important gathering places for feminists in Los Angeles, but also anyone who would travel nationally and internationally. And they sponsored readings by significant women writers of the day. Gloria Steinem was there, Barbara Kingsolver, a number of women who were just establishing their reputations in the 70s and then went on to become quite famous. But Sisterhood fell prey to the same forces that eliminated other independent bookstores, and they closed in the 1990s, but they were one of the longest operating ones. And then New Words was the bookstore in Cambridge, very close actually to the Women's Center, on Inman Square, and the sections that they had represented interest in the community, and they moved the sections around depending on what the interest in the community was. This is one of the brochures that mentions their specialties, and second from on that left column there, the second entry down is women of color. And so they tried to address the interest of women of color and published and carried publications by the Kitchen Table Press, one of the self-started presses in Massachusetts, Women of Color Press. Homegirls, that title on the right, was written by Barbara Smith, who was a black lesbian author and creator of the Combahee Collective. This is a picture of them in the 70s. I don't know which one is Barbara Smith. But they went on to become involved in women's writings, in publishing, and also in health issues for African American women. The last institution I studied were domestic violence shelters. And this is one that was started in Somerville, Massachusetts, which was a more working class neighborhood than Cambridge. And Respond was created by women who had learned of domestic violence through their work with Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, families of alcoholics. And they saw the need for shelter for women, and they just did it. They took women into their homes. There was also another place in Cambridge at the time, Transition House. Women just took battered women into their homes. And this was one of the first places that Respond was able to buy. Now, in the 1970s, it's no longer a domestic violence shelter. In the 1970s, they had to have a board member who was male buy this because their credit was no good. And this is in the 70s. This is why feminists work so hard for equal credit. All right, once women took advantage of these new resources and rights, they earned more degrees, the majority entered the labor force, and spaces emerged that supplied the work that women once performed in the home. And if you think about what women do mainly in the home, it's the care and feeding of dependents, whether they're young or old. Excuse me. And these are the what I'm calling this unintentional spatial consequences from the 1980s and 90s. And these are substitutes for women's care work, the child care, fast food, adult day services. This is one in Los Angeles, and hospices. So for middle-class women, the invisible domestic work of previous generations has been taken out of the home and put into public buildings, typically provided by the private sector. The dilemma, of course, is that unpaid women's caretaking labor has become underpaid work performed by women and people of color and immigrants. Second-wave feminists argued that women would never achieve true equality unless they were relieved of household good tasks, chores. But they had in mind a collective solution in which men and women shared domestic tasks. And I don't think they ever could have anticipated the spatial consequences of outsourcing so much work from the home. So my takeaways here are that constructive feminism encompassed both the legal infrastructure and the material form of women's new rights. But the spaces that deliver caretaking services have become necessary for maintaining those rights. And thus we have the eternal quandary. Until domestic tasks are evenly shared by women and men, the opportunities for middle-class women are built on the labor of lower-income women. And in conclusion, I'll speculate on whether we still need spaces created by and for women, where women's priorities come first. And I argue that we do, especially abortion clinics and domestic violence shelters, and the laws that support them. Until women control the health and safety of our own bodies, the need for constructive feminism will endure. Thank you. These are owners of the bookstore, and this is Carol Downer, the owner of the, or sorry, the founder of the first women's clinic.
And I'm going to take advantage of my position as moderator to get us started. So thanks. Those were both wonderful. I actually have a question for each of you that has to do with possible dialogue between your projects. So Dolores, you made it very clear that Hansel Meis was a leftist, that she supported the labor movement, that she supported minority and immigrant rights, and that as a woman, she herself clearly was exemplary as a kind of pioneering woman. So my question is, she actually, Dolores mentioned that she was born in 1909 in Germany. That means that when the second wave hit in the late 60s, she was just 60 years old, and she lived, I think, into the 90s, right? So I realize I haven't been talking to the mic, but I think you can probably hear my loud voice. So my question is to you, whether or not Hansel Meith was ever explicitly, you know, passionately involved with the second wave women's movement, or did she sit that out? Did she tie it to the rights of lady garment workers? And then maybe just to kind of look ahead, I was interested in, since Dolores has made clear how important this archive of photos was to the labor movement, for example, in her book, which I had the advantage of seeing and you didn't, one example was not only photos by Hansel Meith, but also a photo by Dorothea Lange of the migrant mother. And so clearly, there was a social transformative effect to these photographs, and Dolores makes it very clear that that was really what Meath was most devoted to. So I'm interested in hearing from Daphne. I mean, you included a lot of photos, but I had the sense that you took a bunch of them, and there were sort of sketches and reimaginations. And so I'm wondering, is there not an archive for the second wave women's movement? Was there a Hansel Meith or a Dorothea Lange who was documenting it? I'm actually also sort of a student of the women's movement and gender and sexuality. I couldn't really think of an iconic photo to represent the kinds of spaces that you're talking about. When we think of the first wave, you know, you have the suffragettes in white with their banners. There's a sort of smattering of not really celebratory photos of the second wave women's movement. But so I'm wondering, did photography play a role? If not, does Daphne have any idea why not? But maybe should we start with Dolores, this question about gender politics and Hansel Meith?
I think that's an interesting question. I suspect that if anyone were to ask Hansel Meith if she considered herself a feminist, she would probably have a similar response to when people asked her if she was, you know, for her political affiliation, or if she was a member of the Communist Party, which she was accused of being a member of the Communist Party and was investigated by the FBI along with her husband, Otto Hegel. Her response to the question of whether she was a communist was generally to say, no, I'm not good at handing out leaflets. I don't like to take orders, so I didn't belong to any organized political group. At the same time, she was, as you mentioned, a strong supporter of organized labor and in favor of rights for immigrants, as well as a strong supporter of the peace movement in the 60s. So I think she was a feminist in fact, if not in sort of, even if she didn't belong to a feminist organization. So I think she embraced. Having said that, I would also say she was a very contradictory, complicated person. Mm-hmm. And so she was very independent. And also, within her relationship with Otto Hegel, there was definitely a division of labor. And she had some serious problems financially and running her business, which was a farm by that time in Northern California after his death in the 70s. So kind of a mixed answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about the iconic photo or lack thereof. Maybe some were the images, like the Wonder Woman image. But I did run across numerous archives, and there was a strong women's press at the time, and there were photographers there. And one of the archives I depended on heavily was the June Mazur Lesbian Archive in Los Angeles. And it was an entire building's worth of everything that they had collected from that era. And there were a lot of images of the women's music festivals and the bookstores and all the, you know, the posters. There was a great poster that I couldn't include in this because it had something to say about housework and what could be done with it. So it was the Lesbian Archives. There was also a woman named Joan Bieran, who was part of the Furies Collective in Washington, D.C. And she had thousands of photographs that she had used at feminist events. That Furies Collective was known at the time for being very separatist and creating women-only spaces. And one of its members is Rita Mae Brown, who went on to become an author and a local resident. And she went from writing very radical work to, now she's known more for her cat mysteries, but she had quite radical beginnings. And I think part of the lack of an iconic picture is that the activities were dispersed across so many different communities that sometimes the traditional media would cover it, and sometimes only these women would cover it. The Miss America contest, for example, I've never seen any really good photos of that and the bra-burning trash can and such.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting. Dolores talks about how Hansel Mies profiled there's a guy named Bridge, who was the longshoreman, like union leader. But insofar as the Second Wave Women's Movement was really about being non-hierarchical, as you say, the reformist branch, I think it was the media who had sort of nominated, you know, Betty Friedan or Gloria Steinem. But I think as a matter of policy, there was this desire not to have a strong leader, and maybe that meant that the sort of, you say, the photo opportunities and the imagery was more dispersed. Right. But so questions from you all, comments? Yeah.
To answer your question, at least for me, the 70s and the Women's March on Washington, the ERA is one of the
Yes.
I was there. I felt really strongly about some of those pictures, and of course, the Bob robbery was what the guys all focused on, but that was a pretty special event. I wanted to ask Daphne, when you were traveling around speaking to these women who you've either known or worked with in the did you find something that was really surprising that you didn't anticipate, or did you kind of know how the book was going to lay out over time?
I didn't know what I was going to find when I started it, because I just pieced the ideas together as I went along. And I went to LA thinking I was just going to work with library archives, and then realized that some of these women were still alive and still were in LA. And when I called them, they were pleased to talk, because they hadn't in a while. What they said in Boston, the women who started the domestic violence shelter and the Sisterhood bookstore and the Feminist Health Clinic, is that they thought it was the most important work they'd ever done in their lives, and they lamented the loss of a comparable movement today that would place value on these women-only spaces. Now, some there's not as much of a need for anymore. There were also feminist federal credit unions. Well, the need for those disappeared after banking regulations were changed. But in each case, they all talked about the sense of community those places engendered. And so whereas I was looking at rights and how they were made material, they all thought in terms of community. And I guess that surprised me, because they weren't thinking of rights. I imposed the idea of rights on these places, and once we start talking, they said yes, you know, they could see how that was the case. But they all missed that. The glory days, you know.
Other questions? So I have another question for you, Daphne. So I know you said that, and you illustrated this in terms of the Cambridge Women's Center, that often that women couldn't afford to buy their own buildings, and so they would just appropriate buildings that had been abandoned and remake them in some way. And so, again, I had the advantage of having looked through the manuscript here. Daphne also mentioned that for bookstores, that the space was modified in a way that was really inviting and homey and had chairs and invited people to linger and invited women to bring their children. So I'm wondering, can you be more specific about ways that these spaces were different, not just because they were spaces where women could be together and that for the most part excluded men,
or discouraged men. Were there other sort of material ways that they reshaped the space and sort of reimagined what a bookstore could be, what a health clinic could be?
Right. The women who started the New Words bookstore in Boston, or in Cambridge, had worked at bookstores before, and the practice at that time was for people to come in and buy their books and leave, and no bookstore had chairs or encouraged them to sit and read. So they particularly wanted to do that, and as they did in Sisterhood Bookstore as well. And they described it in retrospect as a type of shabby chic. It was just, you know, it was one step above dorm room furniture, but it was something that people felt okay, you know, comfortable sitting in. In the clinics, they specifically tried to avoid the sterility of the free clinics at the time that were run mainly by men, and then certainly the traditional medical facilities. So they had seating, and one example they described specifically once they were able to provide abortions was that they would have the women come in and sit with other women while they were waiting for the procedure, have the procedure, and then instead of going out the back door, which was the standard practice in other places, they would have the women come back in and sit with those who were awaiting the procedure so they could talk about it and share their experience and prove that they were fine and that it didn't have to be as traumatic as they might worry about. And then they also put artwork on the ceiling. So when women were in, their feet were in the stirrups on the examining table, they had something to look at. Not something you see too often, even in women's centers now. The domestic violence shelters certainly were more home-like because there were so many children who were there as well. And so they had playgrounds, and they really spent a lot of time thinking about how to make children and women satisfied or feel safe. You know, the idea was to make it feel safe. One of the things I did find out in this is that, you know, the whole philosophy during the 70s was to hide the location of shelters. It still is in this country. In the Netherlands, the women's shelter is on a main public street, and it's advertised. And that's because they want it to be recognized as a public health issue. And when I heard that, I thought, well, it makes sense, you know, because it is a public health issue, and feminists were largely responsible for turning that private issue into a, you know, private troubles into a public issue. But people here have a lot more guns than they do in the Netherlands. And so I'm not sure that that model would work here because we're a more violent society.
Yeah. No, thanks. Yeah.
I think in New York City, there was a limited sense of community, in part because she always hated New York City and couldn't wait to leave there. But there were a handful of sort of like-minded photographers like Robert Capa and Carl Meidens that she connected with on some level, either because they had done sort of government work with the FSA or some social documentary kind of work that she felt was more compelling than photojournalism. So there were some pockets of immigrants, and certainly later in her life when she moved to Santa Rosa, there was a community there of leftists who had art. They kind of gravitated around the arts. There was a I don't know if it was a collective, but there was a Marguerite. A German immigrant had a group of potters. She had a school for pottery, and a lot of people, including Bernard Sackheim, who was a muralist, gravitated to Santa Rosa, and there was a community of artists there.
Other questions? Yeah.
Good question. We have had, well, I've seen Carol and Simone two or three times in the last couple of years, most recently in November. And we talked then about third and fourth wave feminism. And, you know, most second wave feminists are concerned that there are no torchbearers. There are very few torchbearers for political change the way there were in the 1970s. So there was some hope that young women would become more politically active, but that doesn't seem to be the way feminism is going. It's a more personal thing now from what I read. The transgender issue we talked about, and that Susan and I were speaking of this before the panel, there are some second wave feminists particularly who absolutely refuse to recognize male to female transgenders now because they say they grew up as men, they experience male privilege, and by turning themselves into women now, they haven't paid their dues, basically. And so the transgender women, male to female women, they're in a battle with second wave feminists. And it's the bathroom thing. You know, I can't believe how much time is wasted on bathrooms, which bathrooms people should go to. And it was the same argument about the ERA. Oh, well, if we pass the ERA, men and women the same bathrooms. Oh, and men and women will have to be in the military and in combat. Well, okay, that's happened, and we haven't come to an end yet. But where I was getting is that all of this infighting, and there are Twitter wars about this and all of, you know, everything going on, completely misses the big picture that all of us have in common, which is protecting reproductive rights. And so while we do this infighting, either between second and third and fourth wave or within third and fourth wave, the big picture out there is that abortion clinics are disappearing and states are doing everything they can to close them down as if the Operation Rescue bombings and murders didn't work. That's the big issue that I think women or feminists should be rallying around, and I don't see that happening, so I'm not so optimistic myself.
I just want to add, Stephanie said we were talking about this before, and it does seem as if there's a certain tension between a kind of separatist, you know, that separatist history, especially at, for example, the Women's Music Festival, and current, you know, transgender visibility and campaigns for transgender rights. At the same time, I actually see, you know, this sort of tipping point around transgender as having come out of, it wouldn't have been possible without both the women's movement and the gay liberation movement. And so on the one hand, we wanted, you know, rights for women, separate spaces for women, safety for women. And at the same time, we were talking about the construction of gender and the fluidity of gender. You talked about how, you know, lesbians were really at the forefront of the radical branch of the women's movement in the 70s. So these issues of rights for sexual minorities and notions about the fluidity of gender really come out of the 70s as well. So it's not that they're, and at that moment, there were all kinds of conflicts too, around race, around, you know, Marxism. I just want to just kind of stress the heterogeneity of views around this, you know, even back then. But I have another, I didn't know if I should try to fit St. Patrick's Day into this, so this actually isn't forced. It's something that is suggested to me by Dolores' research. The issue of white ethnics and German immigrants. And we don't usually think about German immigrants being farm workers. And really identifying both with, you know, the workers in Chinese, you know, sweatshops in Chinatown, or with the internment of the Japanese. And I gather that, you know, that there was a lot of red baiting, but also suspicion of the German background of Meath and her partner. So So I'm interested in that angle of the stories. It seems to me that it calls attention to, you know, this sort of group of white immigrants who, you know, whose history we don't really usually focus on. So I don't know if you want to say more about that.
Well, I know that one of the challenges of being an immigrant at that time was she was a poor immigrant, but there was also the fact that there was having left Germany when Hitler was coming into power, or right before, Otto and Hansel Meath did face, I think, some internal struggles with their German identity. And I know Otto, for one, took an oath to only speak English, and it was a cause for some sort of humorous interactions with Hansel once he arrived first in the U.S., and then she followed. And when they met up in San Francisco, he was refusing to speak German, and she couldn't speak English. And so that misunderstanding ensued. And when he told her that she was going to meet his landlord and that at that time she was supposed to be his wife, you know, in English, she thought he was saying, "I'm taking you to meet my landlord and she's my wife." And she was furious, thinking that he had married this other older woman, and she proceeded to punch him. So she had a temper. But I guess that's getting away from your question. But there was, I don't think they faced a lot of discrimination as Germans per se, but they certainly had a lot of limited opportunities because of their lack of education and their lack of monetary resources.
Other comments or questions? Yeah.
Good question from my transportation planning expert in the class. The Cambridge Women's Center was located in Inman Square specifically for that reason. It was also located there because it was not near any one of the universities. And they did not want, the founders did not want the Women's Center to be associated with an academic institution because they thought it would turn away working class women. But in all of their flyers and PR, they had the location and the Inman Square Metro there. Los Angeles is a different story because they didn't have public transportation at the time. So everything, well, they had bus, sorry, and the Women's Center in LA was located near two main bus routes. And so they talked about making it accessible by bus. I don't know how many people actually came that way. But that would be one of the key issues now, of course, with these places. And the difficulty now, I did talk with these women about why they think there aren't as many women's centers and bookstores. And part of it is that real estate in the city is so expensive now. You know, they were in abandoned places, and it was easy to rent. They didn't buy much, but to rent. And part of what happens around transportation stops is that often the real estate prices go up now. So I don't know if there would be, you know, realistically, there would be the option for more of these places close to transportation stops.
So if there aren't any more questions, it is time for us to think about vacating the space, but not before you have completed evaluations and possibly purchased a book. And if you do purchase a book and would like it signed, our authors will be at back table. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you to our speakers.